Hello, and welcome to the Comic Book Page Weekly Spotlight. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host.
And I'm Bob Retall. In this episode, we'll be spotlighting three comics that came out in shops last week, but that John and I got from DCBS this week. One from DC, one from Marvel, and one from some other publisher. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
The comics we'll be talking about in this episode originally came out on April 9th, 2008. It was actually one of the lightest weeks I've had in a while, Bob. I only got 26 comics this week.
It was lightish. I mean, not one of the 40-plus ones. I got 33 comics, one hardcover, which was an all-original. It's The Education of Hopi Glass by the... Jaime Hernandez, who did Love and Rockets. So I'm looking forward to giving that a read. And then back issue 27. Didn't you get back issue?
I get back issue, but I think I got that last week.
Oh, interesting. They must have just slid it 1 week late for me. And then I got the Death Note DVD volume 4, which has the anime episodes 13 through 16 on it. And I've been getting those. I get the deluxe ones that have these little figures from Death Note in them. So I get kind of like a toy and the DVD all in one. And then I got the Galactus figure that goes with the premium Marvel lead figures. And he stands about half again as tall as the other figure. So it's not like he's, you know, real Galactus scale. They'd have to make him, you know, as big as a Bowen statue or something, like, you know, to do that. But at least he kind of towers above the other guys. So that's fun. So that was my haul for this week. It was a decent amount. I'm feeling a little good because with only 33 books, I'll have at least some kind of chance of being able to catch up.
Tell me about it. Jeez. This was actually the cheapest week I've had, because it was only about $48 after the savings through DCBS. That's the cheapest week I've had since May 2nd of last year.
Wow.
So, and that only by about 4 cents difference. So, but I'm glad it was a relatively light week, because I'm still way behind on my reading. I have... let's see, about 182 items on my new issue to read list, which is far too many.
So. I don't have a specific count, but I'd say I've got about 100 if I had to eyeball it. Other than this week, though, I'm caught up for the most part on DC and Marvel at this point. I have about four DCs from last week to go, and then I'm totally caught up on DC. And then I'll read this week's Marvel and DC just to get myself back up to speed, and then I can start trying to chip away at the indie pile.
Yeah, what I've started doing is just going through the mainstream Marvel and DC, anything in the current continuity, and trying to catch up on that. So I've still got indies from, like, this far back as February 20th. But, you know, any, like I said, mainstream Marvel, DC stuff. But non-mainstream, like, you know, Batman Confidential or the Ultimate Line, stuff like that, I'm putting off until I'm caught up on the kind of the core continuity, figuring that Secret Invasion has already started, Final Crisis is almost here. Kind of want to be caught up on all that.
I'm actually... the ones that I'm like DC, I'm not caught up on my Vertigo books or Wildstorm, for instance, but pretty much the other stuff. Now in Marvel, I don't get as many Ultimate books as you. I pretty much just get Ultimate Spider-Man that comes out on any kind of a regular schedule. So I'm up to speed on Ultimate Spider-Man. I don't get FF and X-Men.
Right.
So shall we dive into Wonder Woman and the Kunz?
Sounds good to me.
The return of Bernard Chang to comics. I don't know if he's done anything else recently. He's the one who used to do Second Life of Dr. Mirage at Valiant, right?
That's right, yeah. Didn't he do something over at CrossGen, maybe?
Might have. But I haven't noticed him in quite a while.
Yeah. He's a good solid artist. I like his stuff.
His style's a little different than I remember it, but still good, clear style. I enjoyed the books. And Gail Simone's run on Wonder Woman, she's been doing a pretty good job, I think.
Yeah. Well, I read both 18 and 19 back-to-back because I was behind, of course.
But so did I.
We're mainly going to talk about 19, but it was a two-part story, so really we're going to cover, I guess, both parts. And it was funny because I thought it was not only a really good Wonder Woman story, it was a fairly good Green Lantern Corps story as well, because they had a member of the Green Lantern Corps in this and playing a fairly important role. And I really enjoyed how they treated the Coons, how they treated the Green Lantern, and how they treated Wonder Woman. It was just good all the way around.
Yeah, it was. You'd always seen the Coons as just the crazy, violent, alien aggressors in mostly like Legion stories, and you never really saw any of their culture. And when they're just straying back a little bit, when they first go to the planet in issue 18, and there's that statue of Wonder Woman,
mm-hmm.
and it's like she looks like it's a big, ugly Kund kind of person with the Wonder Woman outfit on, and they're like, oh, sorry, our sculptors felt they had to pretty you up a bit. No offense is meant. I know you can't help your hideous appearance. You know, it's just...
Yeah, that was pretty funny.
Different standards, different races.
Well, it's interesting because kind of the tack they're taking on the Coons with this is almost like what Star Trek did with the Klingons. You know, they'd been this ambiguous, you know, warrior race or whatever. So let's investigate them. Let's get some culture, whatever, you know, and find out how they think. And some of the beats they're hitting, gee, honor is the most important thing. That kind of stuff is reminiscent of what has happened with the Klingons. But it works here. And, you know, I think they do a fairly good job. Really, I think for one of the first times diving into the Kund culture, because prior to this, I would be hard-pressed to name any time we've really seen much on their home world, in their, or on one of their worlds at least, on, you know, how they think, how their society is, that kind of stuff.
No, agreed. I think it is the first time that we've seen this. So that's what I liked about it. I liked the fact that we got to see this view mm-hmm. of them. So I'm glad I didn't off the top of my head clearly recall the events that they were referring back to. So maybe you can enlighten me and the rest of our listeners if you remember, you know, where she did the solid for the Coons that caused them to come seeking her out here. They're referring back to something in DC history.
I would imagine, because I don't recall clearly either, that goes back to the invasion storyline, because that would have been the time the Coons really attacked Earth with everybody.
Right.
But, you know, my memory on that stuff is far from perfect. But that seems to be what they would be referring to on that. I mean, I can't remember any other time that the Coons really, you know, had any major presence since. But they were one of the races that were a big thing during invasion.
Right. Yeah, that's my... So you're in about the same boat as I was. Because I had, like, vague memories that it was somewhere back there in one of these events. But I didn't recall specifically what it was. So that it didn't harm my enjoyment of the story any. I mean, it's just...
But that's the kind of thing where a simple footnote of, hey, go see this or whatever.
Which is actually a very good point. You know, that, they don't do that anymore. And we've talked about this before, I think. I used to love that in older comics when they would have those little footnotes, rather, mm-hmm. that, you know, hey, you know, if you want to know about this, go back and look at such and such an issue.
Yeah, because it would be enough to say, oh, yeah, that's, you know, I either remember that, I don't. If not, you know, I can go look it up, whatever. But it would give us a starting place to do that.
Right.
Whereas, you know, here it's just we got to take their word for it or whatever. And even if not in the story itself, maybe in the text page afterwards or something like that, but come on. Not only is it a minor continuity point, but it's a marketing point, because if they had done that, that would have given somebody a, hey, you know, I'm curious about that story, maybe I'll go pick up the trade or something like that. But without it, there's no incentive to do that, and there's no direction even if you have the incentive.
That's true. And that would have been a good cross-marketing opportunity for them, too.
Exactly.
So, okay, well, basically, thumbs up. I like how her relationship with Tom Tresser is progressing, although, you know, they're doing some kind of a Steve Trevor kind of thing here. It's coming out of left field a little bit, but...
Yeah,
it seems like I don't mind how it's going. It adds an element back into Wonder Woman that's kind of classic Wonder Woman.
Yeah, it just did seem a little out of left field when they set that up in the previous issue. Not totally. I mean, they'd done a little groundwork for it. It just felt a little forced. And I agree with the using him almost as a stand-in for Steve Trevor.
So. Right. Okay. And move on to Nova number 12.
Yes. And again, I read 11 and 12, so...
Nova number 12.
This was pretty much the second part of a two-part story, so I was glad I just read the previous issue. And one thing I thought was interesting, just in terms of the timeliness of this two-part story, was how... You know, certain characters are showing up here, which reminded me of certain characters showing up elsewhere in the Marvel Universe, that it's almost like there's a certain group, I don't want to say coming back to prominence, but, you know, coming back into some visibility, and it makes me wonder if there's something going on there, big picture-wise.
Yeah. Talking about the characters who appeared on the last page of Young X-Men number 1 that we talked about last week?
Yes, I am.
That is a good point.
So... It was cool to see this particular character back that Nova interacts with for most of the issue here. But frankly, that was one that I'd kind of lost track of over the years and had kind of thought died a time or two. But death isn't what it used to be.
Well, he died here, too.
Yeah, well, he got better.
It's not the same for this particular character.
Yeah, well, that's the joy of dealing with... the cosmic. You deal with other races and...
I don't know how much of a spoiler it is to mention the character, especially in the context of this issue that we're reviewing since he was in the last issue.
Yeah, so, that's true.
I mean, it's Warlock from the New Mutants. Yeah. I think that most people who read Nova or, you know, like just putting it right out, maybe people who aren't reading Nova who really like the New Mutants and like the Warlock character might want to go pick up Nova 11 and 12 because they will get to see Warlock again.
Well, and he's a heavy feature character in certainly 12 and for most of 11 too, I thought.
I mean, he's on mostly every page. I mean, he's pretty much a co-star of these two episodes. So...
Well, and it was kind of, I don't say, again, out of left field or whatever, but I mean, there was nothing in the solicitation stuff to let fans of the Warlock character know, hey, he's going to be in this. If you like him, check it out.
This is true.
So, another marketing opportunity missed.
Yeah, I sometimes wonder about some of these, you know, it's like, well, do you purposely not want people who would be interested in something to know that you're bringing it back so they can come and check it out? I just don't get it sometimes.
I mean, I can see not wanting to reveal, you know, aspects of the story or whatnot, but I don't know. It's puzzling.
And I like the covers on Nova, but for the most part, what Marvel has moved to in a lot of their books, and Nova's one of them, is that the cover has pretty much nothing to do with what's in the book. They're just posters of Nova. You know, they're pinups of the character. I mean, the same thing's true of Iron Man. You know, pretty much any book that's got like an Addie Granov or Greg Horn or, you know, a lot of these kind of covers, they're just pretty much pinups. And there's no indication... You know, hey, Warlock returns in this issue or something like that. I mean, even having it on the stand if I'm a fan of the Warlock character, I might have picked up Nova 11 and 12 if I saw it at the local comic shop and saw that the character was in there. But there is absolutely no indication of the storyline on the cover, and it's the difference between current comic covers, at least mostly at Marvel, and previous covers, because you used to get sort of an indication of what was going to happen in the comic.
Yeah.
And now it's like, well, I see a giant pinup of the character who this book belongs to, and if I like that character, you know, I might be intrigued by this really cool image, but other than that, it is not going to suck me into the story because it tells me zero about the story.
Whereas if you look again at Wonder Woman, both 18 and 19, it clearly mentions the Kund are there. They're featured on the cover in the background and stuff.
That's right.
So if you're interested in that, it gives you a reason to go check it out. If you want to just see, you know, her in space or whatever, you've got a clue. Whereas, you know, issue 11 here of Nova, he's sitting down. Issue 12 here, he's kind of standing up. Doesn't really give you a whole lot of clue what the story's about.
Exactly. And, you know, just the exact case in point, you know, on the Wonder Woman, like you say, it says on the first issue, 18, Return of the Kund. And on the next one, it's kind of like you got the Wonder Woman logo and it says, why is Wonder Woman helping the Kund? And you have in the background, you can see the Kund and things like this. And it's like, wow, I haven't seen the Kund in years. I don't really give a crap about Wonder Woman, but I'd be interested to know what's up with the Kund. I'm going to pick up this issue. You know, here it's like they don't do anything like this. So
now, going back to the Wonder Woman cover for a second, though, there was no indication that there was a Green Lantern involvement on number 19.
Other this than, is true.
There's the green ray beam she's deflecting or whatever, but that could have been anything. So there's still a little room for improvement there, but day and night difference between that and these Nova covers.
Right.
So there's marketing they could and should be doing at a very simple level that I'm just surprised they're not doing.
Yeah, I just don't get it. You know, sometimes it just eludes me. You know, they've gone so much to kind of a generic marketing kind of mode here on these things.
And with Nova, issue 12 very clearly says, hey, you know, it's going to be concluded in Annihilation Conquest number 6. And there's no indication on this cover that this has anything to do with Annihilation Conquest. So there's...
That's true. It doesn't even have a banner at the top. And actually, the last several issues of Nova, I mean, well, I guess if you're reading Annihilation Conquest, you should be sort of aware that this ties heavily into it. But they certainly don't go to too much effort to drive that point home at all, because this story is very closely tied into the events that are going on in Annihilation Conquest. And in fact, in issue 12 here, there are some relatively crucial events that happen with both Gamora and Drax, who are select members of the
Phalanx or whatever, yeah.
The Phalanx. And it's going to play into the conclusion of the Annihilation thing. It's like, well, gee, I'll put a banner. Mm-hmm. But enough. I mean, it's regardless of the marketing difficulties Marvel seems to have on doing something other than put a pretty picture on the cover of their comic books, this was a good set of issues. I like the writing. I like the art. I've been really enjoying Nova since they brought him back. The character is night and day different from his last incarnation. Bopping around on Earth. I really like, he was in space a little bit, but, you know, he was in the New Warriors and all this kind of stuff. His abilities were somewhat marginalized. I really like the whole Nova Force thing, the, you know, kind of like Marvel's version of the Green Lantern Corps, essentially, that they've got going on here.
Yeah. Yeah, they're doing some great stuff in this title, and this is one that I really think isn't getting the attention from the readers that it probably deserves. It's very solid writing. It's excellent art. It's telling a good story, and I think it's doing a lot to really build up the Nova character in much the same way that Immortal Iron Fist has been doing that for Iron Fist. So this is one that I think is selling all right, but could and probably should be selling better based on my perception of the quality of it, at least.
No, I would agree with you on that. Marvel has been doing an excellent job lately on taking characters, especially from the 70s, and I think this is a cyclic thing. You know, a lot of the writers who are and artists who are in comics today, probably more of the writers, are of an age that they got into comics around the 70s and early 80s as kids. And there are these characters that they loved. And this is almost like what happened with, you know, the late 60s and early 70s with people who, you know, were bringing back some of these really cool characters that they had liked as kids over at DC. To some extent, you know, they're bringing back Nope, but they're bringing back Iron Fist, and they're putting a new spin on it, but they're making the character really cool, and they're doing things that are really interesting with them, so.
Yeah, yeah. This is a title I definitely recommend, and particularly if you're following any of the Annihilation stuff, you really ought to be reading this series.
So, this is a thumbs up from us. Move on to Gru, Hell on Earth, from Dark Horse. This is Gru's return to comics after quite a long absence. They had the 25th anniversary special that came out a couple of months before this series, but this is the most regular that we've seen Gru in a long time.
You know, it's one of those things that as much as we're going to be reviewing this particular issue, the fourth of four for this, we're kind of almost going to be reviewing, I want to say, almost the entire run of Gru, because this is one that has probably, I would say, the most consistent quality over the long haul of almost any title I can think of. It's exceptionally well written. It's Sergio Aragonés art, so, I mean, you just can't go wrong with that. The coloring by Tom Luth, the lettering by Stan Sakai, I mean, this is a team that has been together for,
25 years.
Yeah, 25 years.
Gru 25th anniversary one just came out, so that.
But I mean, like 150-ish issues thereabouts.
Yeah.
And I mean, they do their thing, they do it well, and it's arguably a comedy book, but it's to me kind of almost more of I don't want to say a political satire.
This particular series, yes. I mean, this is kind of global warming and pollution and things like that done in a sort of a lighthearted. It's not that heavy-handed, but the elements are definitely there. I mean, you could interpret it that way. There's definite political views being presented here in the overall comedic framework of Gru.
But, I mean, almost every story they've ever told has some kind of a point to it. They take some aspect of our reality and just kind of, you know, poke fun at it and take it to the extreme in some cases.
This is true.
You know, be it about literacy, about politics, about, you know, some other, you know, topic or whatever. And, you know, they kind of put it through Gru's perspective and often Sage's perspective, and the minstrel as well. So, you know,
I love the minstrel. Mm-hmm. Yeah, every time you see him, his lute or lyre or whatever that is, it's got like a different thing up on the neck at the very tip of it. It's got like a different, you know, animal or, you know, whatever. And here I'm looking at issue four. He's got a bunch of flowers on it the first time you see him, and there's a giraffe and there's some penguins, you know, it's just, you know, you have a charging stallion. It's just the character, and Sergio always draws something different every single panel, and his art, you know, you look in the background and it's like everybody's doing something. You know, big crowd scene, and you got like 100 people, and there's something just going on everywhere in these stories. You could read a Gru comic book in 10 minutes, or you could read it in an hour, depending on how much time you want to spend looking at all the detail that Sergio puts into every single panel. If you look at his marginals in Mad Magazine, I mean, you know, he just does like a little tiny thing, and you know, you take that and expand it to the entire size of a comic book page, and you know, I mean, there's just all kinds of detail packed in all over the place.
Yeah, yeah, he's certainly not one to slack off on the art chores. I mean, when he does, you know, a full-page spread or two-page spread or whatever, there is just so much in there, so much going on. And, you know, the crowd scenes are, like you said, fairly intense and busy, but not in a way that distracts from the story. It's just one that there's stuff to look at in the background if you choose to.
Well, that's true. I mean, like I was saying, you know, and it's not, you know, if you read the book in 10 minutes, you get the basic story. I mean, you can read through and you can read the main story, look at the main foreground characters, and get that entire story out of it. But then if you go back, you can look at each individual panel almost, and there's just a whole bunch of other stuff going on in the background and detail and little sight gags and just all kinds of things. Just look at the expressions on the faces of, you know, anybody. It's just so true to what would actually be happening in the scene. Sergio's a master at that. This is certainly I've been reading Gru since the very, very beginning. I'm pretty sure I've got every single Gru appearance, you know, from Destroyer Duck on up through Pacific and Eclipse and Epic and all the different places that he's been. So
I've got a lot of them. I don't have Destroyer Duck. I know I've got, I think, the entire Epic run. I'm trying to remember if I have the Eclipse run or not, but I've been following Gru for much, but not all of the 25 years. And it's, you know, it's a really good series, and it's, I think, got a lot more depth and substance to it than a lot of people give it credit for.
Yeah.
Because both Sergio and Mark are very smart people and just good storytellers. You know, there are times where the writing is just really clever and kind of pointed or whatever, and, you know, an excellent match for the art.
Right. And, you know, Sergio is the writer of these. He comes up with the story.
Yeah.
It's his story and it's his art. And what Mark Evanier does is he takes that story and he puts the voice, by putting the specific words that flesh out the story, into the mouths of the people. You know, so he's the one who comes up with the little rhyming couplets for the minstrel and, you know, what specific turns of phrase people are using. But the basic elements that are here in the story, those are Sergio. And I didn't realize it when I was first, you know, it was a long time into reading Gru before I actually realized that. And I didn't realize how tremendously good a storyteller and writer Sergio was for many, many years also. And, you know, realizing that he was the writer, not the artist, on the original Batlash character.
Yeah.
At DC. And he's writing the revival of Batlash with a co-writer. And now that Darwin Cook has gone off of the spirit at DC, and Sergio's taken over writing chores on that, and he does an excellent job. So he's renowned for being an artist, you know, with his very distinct style, but he's a tremendously talented writer too, and the story ideas that he comes up with. So just reading these Gru books is a treat, in my opinion. So anyone who didn't pick this up, interested at all in this kind of thing, you know, pick up the trade when it comes out. You can pick up the issues. This is just a fun, fun book. Highly recommended.
Definitely, definitely. It's excellent stuff. It's a top-notch creative team that's been doing their thing on this series or this character at least for very, very long, and I don't think it's quite the recognition it deserves. It just keeps going, even when many of the publishers and imprints it's been on have kind of dwindled to dust. Definitely worth picking up.
This is one of those weeks, you know, sometimes you give negative reviews on things, and I liked everything I read this week. We have one extra book this week, Suburban Glamour number 4 by Jamie McKelvey. And again, kind of talk about the whole series here. Jamie McKelvey did Phonogram a while back, also from Image. This book is from Image. I didn't know what I was going to expect out of this when I saw the initial previews of it, but he took this in a completely different direction from what I was expecting. I thought it was going to be kind of like, you know, teens and, you know, out in the suburbs and more of a slice of life, what was happening with them. And then he put a whole twist on it where it turns out that the main character is kind of a fairy changeling who is left with human parents, and there's all kinds of the magical elements in the story, and the fairy people come back, and this issue obviously wraps up the series. I don't want to go into too much more detail without spoiling the story, but that is the story in a nutshell, which should be enough to get someone who likes that sort of thing to know that they definitely want to go pick this up. But the art is beautiful. I love his art in this.
Oh, I would agree with that. That was a lot of why I originally picked this up. It's a nice, clean style. And what I like is it's not only good art, it's excellent storytelling. And there are a lot of places where there are panels with no dialogue, but it's very clear what's going on in terms of why that panel is there. And a lot of, you know, kind of sparse use in certain places of the word balloons to move the story along, because the art does such a great job. This is one that I've really enjoyed the story. Again, the writing was very good, but it was the art that really pulled me in and that I thought was the best aspect of a very good series.
Right, and masterful use of just doing facial expressions. There are several. If you go to the page with the staple and go one more page beyond that.
Yeah.
And at the top of that page, you look at her facial expression, and it's just perfect. I mean, you can see someone, you know, you can see a girl with that expression, you know, exactly what emotions running through it. It totally matches the scene. The gestures, you know, you go a few more pages on, actually just flip one more page, look over on the right-hand side, look at how she's doing the hand gesture there. Mm-hmm. You know, these are things that are small things, but they add so much to pulling you into the story, because the body language, the facial expressions, everything like that is so spot on to, you know, what you would see if you're watching a movie, for instance, you know, of how people act. He's just got a very good eye for capturing reality on the page.
Yeah, I would agree with that entirely. And, you know, it's kind of funny to be talking about that level of reality and something that deals with, you know, fairy type stuff and has a clear fantasy aspect to it. But there's such a, like you said, a good use of the body language, of the expressions, of, you know, just the basic kind of blocking of where people are in relation to other people and stuff, that it has, I almost want to say, like an animated feel, not in terms of the art style, but in terms of the sense of movement in the art. You know, you certainly get you can fill in the blanks between the panels very easily, because he gives you kind of those key frames and enough motion and enough sense of how these people would be acting and moving. Whereas, you know, I've read other comics at other times where maybe it's great art or whatever, but it's got a stillness to it.
Right. Very static.
Exactly.
Well, it's kind of like Greg Land, right? Greg Land, I love his art, but a lot of the images are relatively static, and the storytelling from panel to panel, you just don't get that sense of flow.
Right, right.
You know, that's the difference. You know, a lot of, you know, when you look at an artist who panels in and of themselves are really nice to look at, but then they're not flowing, and almost like, I think it's good what you said, you know, telling that almost animated kind of story, because you can just easily mentally fill in the motion between the panels because everything just looks so natural.
Yeah. This is something that I think would actually make a very good animated feature, both in terms of the art style, the storyline, etc. It seems like it would work very naturally from the comic and stay very true to it. Definitely a fun series and one worth checking out in either if you can find the issues or the trade should be out any time now.
Right. So next, let's play a quick promo for a comic that we heard about thanks to Damien, Lord Shaper, over at the Cryptographic Podcast. And I am tremendously glad he brought this one to our attention. It's called Titanium Rain. It's going to be in next month's previews. This book looks fabulous. You'll see more about this upcoming. We're going to be talking about it on our previews episode. And we'll also have an interview with the creators on our next previews episode at the end of the episode. So listen to the promo and see if it sounds good to you. And we'll catch you next time.
In the year 2031, mankind's survival instinct is put to the test when a civil war in China spirals into global conflict. Nations are destroyed, millions are killed, and for many, like U.S. Air Force pilot Alec Killian, survival will mean shedding some of his humanity in exchange for biotech and machine. Is this the ultimate corruption of nature, or the birth pains of a new chapter in mankind's evolution? This is Titanium Rain. From the team who brought you the acclaimed series Utopias, Titanium Rain is a sci-fi war epic for the post-millennial age. In the spirit of films such as Ghost in the Shell, Innocence, and Black Hawk Down, Titanium Rain follows one pilot's journey through mankind's worst, only to discover its best.
Available from Archaea Studio Press. Order Titanium Rain, Issue 1, in the May copy of Previews Magazine.
Join us next week when we discuss Batman and the Outsiders number 6 from DC, Captain Marvel number 5 from Marvel Comics, and Noble Causes number 32 from Image Comics, and a look at a bonus book, DC Wildstorm Dream War number 1 by special request from listener John Carroll.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.